you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
They say the neon lights are bright on Broadway.
On Broadway.
They say there's always magic in the air.
On Broadway.
But when you're walking down that street and you ain't had enough to eat, the glitter of light and you're nowhere.
The great voices of the Drifters, and one of many wonderful compositions and lyrics by the songwriting team of Cynthia Weil and Barry Mann, Brill Building composers in New York City, along with Carole King and Jerry Goff and so many other great writers. We lost Cynthia Weil on Friday at the age of 82. Throughout Air Talk today, we're going to play some of the great music that she and Mann composed over the years. And the variety is absolutely extraordinary. Speaking of entertainment, our John Horn joins us to talk about the tentative deal reached between the Directors Guild of America and the motion picture producers. John, thank you for joining us. What does this mean for television residuals, first of all, which is a big issue with the Writers Guild?
Yeah, there are not a lot of areas where the Directors Guild overlaps with the Writers Guild or even the Screen Actors Guild. But the Directors Guild said that their tentative deal includes really improved residuals for streaming, especially overseas, overall minimum wages, creative rights, diversity. Even there's a clause in the contract to protect actors or people on sets from live ammunition, which obviously took the life of Helena Hutchins on the Rust set. But both the Writers Guild of America and the Screen Actors Guild immediately after the DGA made their deal said, congratulations, this doesn't affect us. I should note the Directors Guild of America is by far the least militant guild in Hollywood. It either has never been on strike or was on strike for about a minute when the East Coast and West Coast.
There's debate over how many minutes
maybe it was
they were
two,
on strike.
Yes. Yeah. So anyway, both the Writers Guild and the Screen Actors Guild have said they're not going to follow the Directors Guild model, and the Screen Actors Guild opened their negotiations on Wednesday.
Okay. And John, we're also expecting the results pretty soon from a strike authorization vote from SAG-AFTRA members.
Yes, that should be out very soon. You and I are both SAG-AFTRA members, as is Mariana, but we are not covered by that contract with producers. And I suspect that's going to be a overwhelmingly positive vote, as it was for the Writers Guild. That doesn't mean SAG is going to go out when its contract expires on June 30th. It gives its negotiators the ability to call for a strike immediately. I talked to a screenwriter over the weekend. He doesn't think there's any scenario in the next couple of weeks where the Writers Guild are able to even have negotiations. The Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers is going to go to work on the SAG deal. They may not even speak to the writers until July 1st at the earliest. And this screenwriter doesn't think there's going to be. He told me, I don't think they want to make a deal. He's really that dire. So I think we're really, even though we're 5 weeks in now to the Writers Guild strike, I think we're in it for the long haul now.
Of course, as a practical matter, they need writers because AI is not developed to the point where it can write everything that needs to be produced.
Well, and this is a part of the DGA deal that they said that they made great improvements on AI and directing. Now, AI for directors is not nearly as big of an existential issue as it is for writers or actors. You know, a robot can write text. It could have written my answers to some of your questions here. But can a robot give Vin Diesel direction on a movie set? I'm not sure any human director can do that. But anyway, I think that even though the DGA made gains in AI, it's not that relevant to how much of a threat it is to writers and actors.
We're talking with John Horn, LAist entertainment reporter, talking with us about the DGA and its effect on what's going on. John, just a quick final note about, if the emphasis is on SAG-AFTRA, does that mean all the eggs are going to be in avoidance? avoiding a strike with the actors, then they go back to the writers? Is that
thinking? That would be the hope of the film and TV studios and streamers. I mean, no, listen, nobody wants to be on strike. Everybody wants a deal that they think is fair. The Writers Guild doesn't think the AMPTP offer, the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers offer, is fair. If they are able to make a deal with SAG, that is very good news for the Writers Guild, because their interests are much more aligned than those two guilds, SAG and WGA, are with the directors. So if the Alliance can make a deal with SAG, I think that's very good news for the writers. Let's see what happens.
Well, especially since SAG-AFTRA are not going to be shy about striking if it comes to that.
No, and they are very much aligned with the writers in terms of residuals, in terms of the threat of AI. They have a lot more overlapping contract issues than either guild has with the directors.
All right, John, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And as John had said previously, we are here members of SAG-AFTRA, though not covered by the contract that has expired and is up for negotiation. You're listening to Air Talk on LAist 89.3.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Contract talks have stalled with the L.A. and Long Beach port complex. And, of course, that disrupted cargo activity Friday at our local ports. And it's not just those, but other West Coast ports. Oakland, Seattle, and Tacoma, Washington are also affected. Joining us to talk about it, editor and reporter for Bloomberg, covering the ports and supply chain, Laura Curtis. Laura, please share with us, what are the big issues of dispute between the dock workers and the port operators?
Hi, Larry. Thanks so much for having me. That's right. We're keeping an eye on things today. We're not sure if these disruptions are going to continue beyond the weekend. But as you say, the contract talks appeared to have stalled over issues of pay at this point. They've had breakthroughs on tentative agreements on other sticky issues like automation and some benefits, but what remains is pay, and that's sort of where we are.
And did the union call for this job action at the ports?
Well, that is very unclear. The union, it started on Friday with a statement from the local union here, Local 13, which represents dock workers in Southern California. They said that they were taking it upon themselves to voice their displeasure with the stance of their employers, but that cargo operations continue as normal. So that was the official line from them, and the international president Willie Adams came in a little bit later in the day to sort of back them up and say, you know, listen, we worked really hard during the pandemic. The carriers made this huge profits, while we were moving all this cargo, and it's time for us to partake in the get our fair share.
So, what do we know this morning about what's happening at Long Beach and Los Angeles? Have any of the docks there been shut?
Well, we know that one terminal at the Port of Los Angeles side has been closed. There was an announcement yesterday morning, so not the kind of last minute situation that we saw that was so disruptive on Friday. There are no other official closures to the terminals reported yet. We're keeping an eye on that, though, because sometimes these things can take a little while to develop. If there's a labor shortage, it's not clear right away, and the truckers will go wait at the gates for a while before before it gets real jammed up.
About 175,000 Southern California workers work either directly at the ports or in ancillary businesses that are related to the operations of the port. The value of freight that's moved out of our local ports, $469 billion a year. And we've got more than 22,000 dock workers at 29 West Coast ports. They've been working without a contract since July 1st. Do we know the size of the raises, Laura, that they're looking for? Just real briefly, is this like inflation driven or more that just the logistics industry is booming?
I don't know. I don't think that we know that at this point. You know, it's complicated by the fact that cargo has shifted away from Southern California ports. As these talks have gone on, retailers and importers are concerned about delays and have moved some of their cargo over to the Gulf and East Coast. And in that time, carrier profits have gone way down. Some of them reported a loss actually this quarter. So the contours of this negotiation are changing.
Laura, thank you very much for being with us. We sure appreciate it. That's editor and reporter for Bloomberg, covering the ports and supply chains, Laura Curtis with us.
Support comes from Japan House LA, presenting Yes, Kawaii is Art. Express yourself. Kawaii translates to cute or adorable, yet its influence extends beyond aesthetics to encompass fashion, art, technology, and even social behavior. Sebastian Masuda, the king of kawaii, brings together multiple artworks unraveling the kawaii concepts to foster a sense of joy, innocence, and community as a tool for self-expression and representation. Visitors can step into this colorful world to feel the aesthetic for themselves. May 2nd to November 3rd. No admissions fee. More at japanhousela.com.
Another Cynthia Wild Berry Man composition. The couple collaborating on music and lyrics of a big hit for the Pointer Sisters. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3 as we're remembering the music of Cynthia Wild, who passed on Friday. And throughout the course of our 2 hours, you'll be hearing the incredible range and different eras of music for which they composed. But we turn our attention right now to a pension plan that was established way back in the 70s and then was finally implemented in the 1980s for California's boxers to have some sort of a pension available to them so that they would be able to have money to help them, particularly if they're not able to be employed, you know, later in life. The first payout came in 1999. $4 million in total has been paid out to former boxers in California. But Melody Gutierrez, with an investigative piece in the Los Angeles Times, discovered that only a fraction of the money and of the boxers who were entitled to the money were meeting up. Melody, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it. So what's been the hang up with the State Athletic Commission being able to track down the boxers and pay them?
Yes, thank you for having me. So this investigation found that roughly 200 boxers could have a claim today as of last year, and only 12 of them were paid last year. And so that's 6%. The investigation really found that the Athletic Commission was not set up to find boxers who are owed these pensions. So when a boxer wasn't claiming them, they were being added to a list of those owed. And there really wasn't a lot of effort, a lot of an ability by the Athletic Commission to actively find some of these boxers who were owed money.
You profiled some of the boxers and how much of a difference it would make. Almost uniformly, no one knew anything about this. How is it the boxers didn't know that there was a pension plan with money available to them once they reached a certain age?
Well, the pension experts I spoke to pointed out to one area in particular where the Athletic Commission was sort of failing these boxers, and that is that they weren't notifying boxers when they first vested, meaning that they became eligible for these benefits in the future. And by not doing that, the Athletic Commission was actually reaching out to boxers for the first time to let them know that they were owed these pensions at 50 years old. And by that point, the Athletic Commission's addresses on file were no longer good. So that was why you were seeing such a huge disconnect between boxers having no idea that they had qualified and then hearing for the first time, either from me or from media stories about this pension, that they were owed this money.
Now, you're no amateur at this. You are an investigative reporter, so you know how to find people. But how difficult was it to track down the boxers?
They really ranged. There were some that were particularly hard, that required me to reach out to acquaintances. One of them I profiled in the story, Milford Kemp, was somebody who did take a little bit of effort for me to find. But he was a street performer, a Jimi Hendrix street performer in Canada. And so there were enough leads online. He has a pretty large online profile. So he was, you know, a little harder to get his cell phone number and connect with him. But there were certainly others, fairly close to the Athletic Commission's offices and all throughout California that were more of a Google search in order to just find their most current address.
As you report, if a boxer dies before the age of 50, that the benefits to which they are entitled could go to their heirs. Is that something about, I mean, if they're not reaching out to the primary beneficiaries, I assume the heirs aren't being reached out to as well.
Right. I did talk to a couple beneficiaries who had no idea. One particularly who I spoke to just last week, you know, he actually is a boxer. His dad was a boxer. His dad had died at the age of 45, unaware that he had a pension. And in talking to this this gentleman, he was saying, like, you know, I think I have one, but I'm not quite sure either. And so there are quite a few beneficiaries who were unaware of the, that they had a claim that they could file. In addition, this pension can be used at age 36 for vocational education. Mm. And that's one of the issues with reaching out to boxers for the first time at 50, which is, you know, that means that they're unaware that they could have used it much earlier for either medical expenses or for vocational education.
And you found current boxers, professional fighters in California, they don't seem to be aware of this, even though part of the purse is going into this pension fund?
Yes, I did talk to some current boxers. There is a much more of an awareness among current boxers than retired boxers. And I think part of that is just simply, you know, if you had heard of it, maybe you didn't, you know, remember, or you didn't know if you qualified, and so you kind of forgot about it. But certainly with the older boxers, when this pension plan was very new and wasn't making payments, there was far less awareness about it.
We're talking with investigative reporter for the Los Angeles Times, Melody Gutierrez, who's written a series of stories about California's one-of-a-kind boxer pension program that was rolled out in 1982 after being passed by the legislature back in the early 70s. First payout in 1999, and there are significant funds that have not been dispersed to former fighters who are eligible. With us, the executive officer of the California State Athletic Commission, Andy Foster. Andy, thank you for being with us. What effect has Melody's coverage had on the commission?
It's hopefully highlighted the efforts of media outlets like yours that will get the message out to the boxers that we can reach and and try to pay. I mean, one thing that you said just a while ago, and I wanted to correct, is there is no purse of these boxers that is being taken out for this fund. This is financed through the commission regulatory scheme on promoters.
So let me just clarify, and I missed, I'm sorry, I misstated. It's actually out of box office receipts, isn't it?
That's correct.
Yeah.
It's not paid for by the boxers, which is, you know, anytime that you have money coming out of your purse, you're probably more likely to pay attention to things. And certainly the Athletic Commission has been making efforts. I mean, of the 245 people that have been paid since 1999, 195 of them have been paid in the last 10 years. We have upped our efforts. We're going to continue to up our efforts. We've got an investigator that's going to be coming in to help us find these folks. But as Ms. Gutierrez mentioned, some of these folks are incredibly difficult to find. We've worked with the Mexican consulate because many of them, sir, are foreign nationals. Not all, but a lot of them. And that's what's unique and special about this pension fund is you do not have to be a California resident to vest. You do not have to be an American citizen to vest. If you come here and you fight and you meet the requirements of the 75 rounds without a break in service, you qualify under this regulatory program that the commission set up.
Now, are MMA fighters, I know you yourself have been an MMA fighter, are they covered by this or only boxers?
No, sir, only the boxers currently. We are, in fact, the Assembly Bill 1136, sponsored by Mr. Haney out of San Francisco, has passed the Assembly and is headed towards the Senate. So it's the hope that these benefits that the boxers can get it, the mixed martial arts fighters and the Muay Thai fighters that the commission regulates should be able to get it as well.
All right, we're talking with Andy Foster, Executive Officer of the California State Athletic Commission. You mentioned the challenge of reaching retired boxers who might be living in Mexico or in other countries, but who fought professionally often enough in California to qualify for the pension. But Melody's writing, you know, found that there were people who just with a simple Google search could be found locally to get their pension. So is your staff reprioritizing reaching the low-hanging fruit of people locally who are eligible?
Well, we're working on, like I said, we're going to work to hire an investigator on the next fiscal year when we get new appropriation. I would just remind you, sir, we don't take general fund appropriation, the commission's special fund, so the taxpayers aren't paying for the commission's operations. So we have to hire the staff as we have the appropriation and the revenue and the money for it. COVID hit the commission really hard. We were in the process of doing this before COVID. Then COVID struck, and the commission's revenues plummeted 80%. But we're back on track now, and we're gonna look to get as many of these this backlog of folks like this 200 that Melody's mentioned. This is a lot of these people are backlogged from years ago.
Okay.
And we're going to try to get them paid.
All right, Andy, appreciate it very much. Another thing that Melody points out in her coverage that's so important is that for current boxers might make a difference whether they fought again in California or in a neighboring state, because that California fight, for example, might put them over the top in qualifying for the pension. Our thanks to investigative reporter from the Los Angeles Times, Melody Gutierrez, Andy Foster, executive officer for the California State Athletic Commission.
Just a little loving early in the morning beats a cup of coffee for starting off the day. Just a little loving when the world is yawning makes you wake up feeling good things are coming.
Listen to Dusty Springfield all day. Another great song that she was able to record, written by Cynthia Weil and Barry Mann, the songwriting team based at New York's Brill Building before moving west. Cynthia Weil passing on Friday, and we are listening to some of the great songs that they composed and for which they wrote the lyrics. We have more to come throughout the rest of this 2 hours of Air Talk today, with a bonus hour coming up at 11 o'clock. But as you know, throughout the course of the pandemic, we have been on top of the very latest developments, and one of the outstanding research questions about COVID is long COVID. And we now have early findings from a National Institutes of Health study looking at symptoms associated with long COVID and the frequency. Joining us from Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, Director of Infectious Disease and Prevention, Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. Dr. Schreiner, good morning. Thank you so much. And first of all, your thoughts about the finding that about 10% of the people in the study who had had COVID are exhibiting the long COVID symptoms.
Well, good evening, and thank you for having me. I think that what we're seeing as we move through this pandemic, some of the long-term consequences of initial infection and recurrent infection. And it does continue to be a challenge for so many people, this very debilitating fatigue and kind of neurocognitive changes that are really life-altering and often prevent people from working or carrying on their job. As you know, we have a long COVID clinic at Huntington, and it's been recognized really fairly soon after the beginning of the pandemic that some people didn't seem to be able to shake the infection. Although the acute manifestations seem to have resolved, they still have these really persistent symptoms, which seem to be quite common, certainly was with Delta, Alpha, and Beta viruses, but also can occur with Omicron, which is what some of the recent studies have shown as well. About 10% of folks with Omicron infection can go on to develop some types of symptoms associated with post-acute sequelae of COVID or long COVID.
Some of the symptoms they were looking at it's associated with long COVID are what's called brain fog, post-exertional malaise, heart palpitations, number of different gastrointestinal symptoms are associated with it. Sometimes can be up to severe fatigue, changes in desire for or capacity for sex, loss of smell or taste long-term, excessive thirst, a chronic cough, chest pain, a lot of symptoms. Do we know from this study any more about what's associated with developing long COVID? Are there people who might have gotten a more serious case of COVID? Were they individuals who might have been dealing with autoimmune diseases prior? What do we know?
Well, we do know some more information. Each day that goes by, as we study this really debilitating and disturbing disease, as we learn more about it, and we are beginning to see patterns that may give us a clue as to what the cause is. But probably there are certainly folks that are at risk for developing long COVID. We know that, again, some of the earlier variants of SARS-CoV-2 were more likely to produce prolonged symptoms because of the severity of the disease. So we know that folks that had a really bad case of acute COVID may be at higher risk for developing developing long COVID. We know that individuals that have underlying autoimmune diseases, as you mentioned, they may be at risk for developing long COVID after they've had acute COVID. Folks that have diabetes or other immunosuppressive disorders might be at risk. But it can also occur in people that really didn't have any kind of predisposing factor. I have quite a few young people in our clinic that were highly functional, had their bout of COVID, maybe were sort of sick with it, but maybe not even that much, and then just haven't been able to shake the symptoms for months and months afterwards. And so there's many manifestations of it. We are beginning to see some of the same kind of patterns with the neurocognitive dysfunction, the brain fog and the exertional fatigue and some of the joint pains, some of the vascular stuff that may happen a little bit with sort of a microclot theory. So it's very baffling, although we are beginning to get some ideas of what it could be and what's happening in the immune system that this virus seems to cause damage to.
Dr. Kimberly Schreiner of Huntington Hospital with us, infectious disease expert. Dr. Schreiner, do do we know what the psychological effects are? Because, you know, for people dealing with chronic illness, so often it has a serious effect on mental health. If you feel debilitated and exhausted all the time, you can't do things that you did, or there's discomfort or pain associated with it. And what's available to help people go through the mental health manifestations of long COVID?
Well, you're absolutely right, Larry. And I think the first thing is that many of these folks have been kind of dismissed by perhaps physicians that aren't very familiar with the fact that, that SARS-CoV-2 can do this. And so validation is a very important important thing for people that are experiencing these symptoms. And I would recommend that if individuals feel like they really haven't been able to shake a lot of the symptoms of COVID, they're having persistent fatigue or difficulty thinking, sort of executive level thinking, or having joint pains after they've had COVID, that they should seek out a long COVID clinic, because they can enroll in some of the studies that are being done so we can get a better idea of what's going on. But you're absolutely right. The psychological effects of it are quite debilitating. Often they aren't able to work. Their levels of daily activities can be interrupted. It is a criteria for disability, short-term and long-term disability. But I think there's many folks that just feel like they haven't, people sort of dismiss them as being neurotic or, you know, it's not real. And I will tell you that it is definitely a real thing, and there are real immunologic inflammatory markers that suggest that.
Yeah, it's not like you can't find evidence of it, objective evidence that it's occurred for people. And one of my hopes, we've talked about this before, is that this will help with people who have other chronic conditions, like chronic fatigue, for example, be able to be taken more seriously. Do you see that happening with more people having experienced long COVID?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, as we're seeing with HIV and all of the very important developments because of that disease, we'll be doing the same with
Dr. Schreiner. I'm sorry, we just lost you on your on your phone. I'm so sorry. If you could just move a little bit, see if we can reconnect with yourself.
Can you hear me now,
yeah,
Larry?
Yeah, that's good. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry about that. I think that the more we understand what's going on with the immune system in the setting of long COVID, the more we're going to understand about other diseases like chronic fatigue syndrome and other debilitating sort of vague diseases that interrupt people's lives.
We're talking with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Director of Infectious Disease and Prevention at Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. We have only about 10 seconds so left, but thank you so much, Dr. Schreiner, as always. We really appreciate you being with us. Thank you.
It's always
Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. The most played song in radio history. The Righteous Brothers singing it, of course. Another Cynthia Wild, Barry Mann composition.
I do. It makes me just feel like crying. Cause baby, something
support comes from Ciclavia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclavia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclavia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.
Just like you've done before, and wrap my heart round your little finger.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Another composition of Cynthia Weil and Barry Mann. Cynthia Weil left us Friday at the age of 82, but she and her husband, songwriting partner Barry Mann, left such an incredible musical legacy. All 2 hours of Air Talk, we're playing music. You can hear the range of genres and how over a 40-plus year career their music evolved. So good to have you with us today. Coming up later on, as we do over the course of our member drives, our backbone segment, and we're going to be talking with our chief engineer about all that goes into keeping LAist 89.3 on the air. But it's my pleasure to welcome the two candidates for District 6 LA City Council. This is the final election. Big field, of course, the first time around in the spring. And now Marissa Alcaraz and Imelda Padilla are facing off for this seat. Marissa Alcaraz is Environmental Policy Director and Deputy Chief of Staff to LA City Council member Curran Price. And Imelda Padilla has been a longtime San Fernando Valley community leader and organizer. It's very good to have you both with us to talk about your campaigns and to try and differentiate a little bit, if we can, over the course of our minutes together to give people a sense of you. But Marissa, let me ask you just to start. Briefly, what is it you feel are the best couple of attributes that you bring to this position if elected? Your strengths.
Well, thank you, Larry, for having us today. I really appreciate it, and bringing light to this election. As you said, you know, maybe not everyone here lives in Council District 6, but maybe they know people that live in Council District 6. And it's so important to vote, especially in special elections. We have such low voter turnout. So really encouraging people to get out there and vote. This person represents not just CD 6, but it's one of 15 members on a city council making citywide decisions.
For millions.
For millions. For yeah. millions of
Angelinos. Very influential position. So, yeah, what do you bring to this if elected?
Well, I mean, first of all, I bring experience to it. You know, I've worked in government for a decade now. And so, you know, when it comes to writing policies, I know how to write policies. You know, I worked to do the $15 minimum wage, to ban the box on job applications asking about people's criminal history, doing hero pay during the pandemic for our frontline workers. I've worked on budgets. I've built a lot of housing at all levels, especially for our homeless neighbors. And so I know how to do the job. I can hit the ground running on day one. And I've been a big proponent for, you know, our working class families. And that's why I think I have a lot of backing from labor and from, you know, all of the hotel workers, grocery workers, electricians, you know, all the people who really represent the Valley.
And please elaborate just very briefly, because I want to talk with Imelda Padilla in a moment. But for, you know, when you said you've created housing, what are you referring to specifically?
I've helped to do a number of things, either property acquisitions, land use development, master leasing properties, doing temporary shelters. I've been part of a team. We've built over 4,000 units of affordable or permanent supportive housing.
And this is part of your job with Council Member Price's office, correct?
Yes. And I think that we haven't seen that kind of investment and work in Council District 6. And that's where I was born and raised. And I've lived for over 30 years. It's where I'm now raising my daughter.
Which part of District 6, which community there?
Van Nuys Lake Balboa area. I went to Birmingham High School. You know, I still live down the street from there. I live down the street from my parents. My family all still live in this area. My daughter goes to school in the area. And all right. So I wanted to see change in my community. And I just haven't seen the change in the last few decades, where the same people have been rotating in and out of office.
That's Marissa Alcaraz running for District 6 LA City Council member. Imelda Padilla, same question for you. What are the attributes that you would bring to this job if elected?
Well, thank you. Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here. You know, I think what I bring to this seat is someone who can potentially get to city council and from day one be able to list and get started on the important issues that this district is prioritizing because of the many years that I've been involved with field work. And I think that that's important. And then, you know, I think this is a good opportunity to mention that this is precisely why I was able to earn the endorsement of both the editorial boards of La Opinión as well as the LA Times, where they specifically mentioned that, you know, for a city council member, there's more need than just policy expertise, but also the ability to rally up the community and get the community engaged in things that are important to them. Just kind of given the structure of bureaucracy, you know, and the ability for the everyday person to get involved in issues related to city council, it's important to be able to work with them and help them navigate the system and really be an advocate. And I think that I bring that skill set of knowing how to listen and understand this very diverse community. But also at the same time, you know, I've been in the trenches of understanding the frustration over bad generational decisions related to land use, lack of investment in transportation, and definitely a lack of interest in creating the housing that has caused, you know, the homeless kind of crisis that we see in District 6.
Can you elaborate a bit? You mentioned sort of field work that you've done and that you see as the most important experience. Can you give an example of something where you did that, a major project?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, really early on from, you know, coming home from college, I was involved in a community policy campaign called Clean Up Green Up, where we were specifically trying to designate regions of District 6 and some of 7, and as well as the community of Boyle Heights and the community of Wilmington to be designated communities that a cumulative impact of environmental injustices, and therefore moving forward, if anybody were to try to get a permit in that space, they have to concede to environmental mitigations. I was one of the lead organizers on that campaign amongst, you know, these three different communities. I did it for the San Fernando Valley. My contribution was helping to get the first endorsement from a business organization. It was the Southern California Auto Dismantlers Association. And that was just at the beginning of my career.
All right.
So,
I appreciate the example. And where in the district do you live?
I live in Sun Valley.
All right.
But I was born in Van Nuys.
All right. Very good. And product of LA City Schools?
Absolutely.
We're talking with Imelda Padilla and Marissa Alcaraz. They are the final two candidates for the LA County District 6 election, which is coming up very soon. You should have received your ballot in the mail. The first day to vote by mail was Tuesday of last week. The last day to register to vote by mail is June 12th. And the runoff election, the final day is June 27th. You can even do same day registration if you want to vote at a local vote center on the 27th. That, of course, in this special election within Council District 6. Marissa Alcaraz, I wanted to talk with you about specifically homelessness policies. You told our Frank Stoltz, our Civics and Democracy reporter, that you would support a ban on RVs parking on residential streets where people essentially would be living in them. Just elaborate a bit. What are some of the measures you think that could be taken, Marissa, that would help to deal with visible homelessness?
Well, you know, homelessness is the number one, you know, humanitarian crisis facing our city right now. We keep working to find solutions out of it, but we keep seeing the numbers increasing. I'm definitely hopeful with our new mayor, Karen Bass, and her emergency declaration and her new push with Inside Safe and the money that was funded in the budget, $1.3 billion, that we're hopefully turning a corner. And we're going to be taking a more regional approach to address the crisis. But, you know, I've gone on record. I've said, you know, look, I'm a mom. I believe that we shouldn't have encampments near sensitive youth sites where kids are going to school, playing in the park, daycare centers, et cetera. And, you know, same with the RVs. We've allowed policy around RVs to expire. And there's just been this piecemeal approach by the council declaring oversized vehicle areas restricted, and there's no comprehensive solution there. So, you know, we need to bring back code sections to deal with the issue. But it's more than that. We need to have the outreach teams talking to people living there. We need to be offering them vouchers to move into housing and to relinquish those vehicles. And we need storage space to put them.
We're talking with Marissa Alcaraz, Environmental Policy Director, Deputy Chief of Staff, Councilmember Curran Price's office. But she's running to be a colleague of Councilmember Price, District 6, L.A. City Council, as is Imelda Padilla joining us as well, longtime Valley community leader and organizer. We'll hear what Imelda has to say about homelessness in her district when we continue.
There's a new world coming, and it's just around the bend. There's a new world coming, this one's coming to an end. There's a new voice calling, and you can hear it if you try. And it's growing stronger with every day that passes by.
We're playing music composed by Cynthia Weil and Barry Mann. Cynthia Weil, who passed Friday, the age of 82, writing music over multiple decades. That was a big hit, actually, for Mama Cass Elliott, but I'm partial to the Nina Simone version. It's a beautiful production of that song as well. It's Air Talk on LAS 89.3, where we're listening to music composed by Weil and Mann throughout the course of the 2 hours today. Right now, we're in the midst of I guess we shouldn't call it a debate. It's a conversation with the two candidates for District 6, L.A. City Council, San Fernando Valley District, Imelda Padilla and Marissa Alcaraz joining us. Imelda, I want to pick up on what Marissa was just talking about, homelessness policies. First of all, the RV policy. Do you support not allowing RVs to park in residential neighborhoods?
Yes, actually, I think we need to do way more work related to removing or creating the opportunities to move RVs both out of residential but also industrial. I live in a community where we have a lot of industrial zoning, and those job creators are equally frustrated as much as residents. It's created a situation where some of those spaces are no longer useful when you can't back up an 18-wheeler into the lot and get business done. So I think this is going to be a priority for me if granted this opportunity, because it's not, it's not just an individual staying in an RV, but it's the obstruction of the sidewalk. It's the lack of, sanitary resources that just creates these large communities of multiple RVs being together that we have to really focus on. And I want to know, who are these individuals? I want to work with the county to find out, and their related departments. Are they veterans? Are they victims of domestic violence? Do they have mental health needs or substance abuse support? Because in what I've observed is that they've been there, the same individuals, for a very long time. So my observation, my criticism, is that because there's been a lack of city leadership wanting to do the work with other agencies is why it's ballooned out of control.
I want to broaden the discussion on homelessness just a bit, because one of the issues, and this is not unique to District 6, but when specific projects come up, residents will often be concerned about what it means for their quality of life. They'll be concerned about crimes or being hassled by people that might live in facilities that are adapted or constructed for people who've been living on the streets. So how do you intend to both represent those concerns of constituents, but also try and make progress on housing people living on the streets of District 6?
you know, I think we have some best practices that have already happened in the community. I like to use the difference between the development of the LA Family Housing Development on Lancashire versus the one that is on Sunland in Sun Valley. The one that was designed and created on Lancashire, for multiple reasons that I am still trying to learn a little bit more about, they don't have a very good relationship with their neighbors. However, the one that's on Sunland, a lot of people, I rarely hear any complaints, but I do vividly remember that when that was in design, it was designed hand in hand with a lot of people from the neighborhood council. And it was the neighborhood council folks who really said, you know, we really want to make sure that this facility has open space inside so that individuals are not necessarily loitering or, you know, for whatever reasons, just kind of, you know, being in the neighborhood without necessarily having to be. And it was those sort of opportunities for engagement that I think created for a better model in that space. So what I want to do is, as we build, make sure that community individuals don't feel like they're left out in conversations of design and services and, you know, how we can, you know, live together and work together and make it better.
And I'm glad, Imelda Padillo, you brought up neighborhood councils, because that's a good segue into that. And just as brief as you could be on this answer, Marissa Alcaraz, to what extent would you be taking input from the neighborhood councils representing your district?
I would meet with them. You know, every meeting that they had, I would either be there or have a team member assigned to go to those meetings. You know, I'm going to, I think, Lake Balboa Neighborhood Council this week and the Valley Alliance in Sun Valley next week. So, you know, for the last 6 months, I've been meeting with the neighborhood councils. We both took part in a neighborhood council debate as well. So, you know, listening to them is vital to, you know, having that input from the community. And, you know, I look forward to working with them.
How much weight do you give them, though? Because one of the complaints, and I'm not speaking specifically of District 6, but that we hear from members of neighborhood councils is they feel often that, you know, an aide will come out, a field deputy, but they're heard, but that action doesn't often come from it, that really the leverage being applied at City Hall to the council members is coming from elsewhere than from the neighborhood council. So what specifically would you, I don't know if pledge is the right term, but promise in terms of the influence they would have on you?
Well, I would promise to listen to the neighborhood councils. You know, I've found in the last, you know, since starting this whole run back in December when I decided to do this, that's where I've heard the most from the neighbors about their issues. You know, whether that's Sun Valley and them talking to me about needing more lighting, tree trimming, sidewalk repairs, help with Sheldon Park, the skate park there, in Panorama, a lot of people talk to me about the Montgomery Ward site, how it's sat vacant for decades now, that they want development and change. North Hills, I went to their community park out there. They want to expand the park. I went there when they brought the PAL program back there. Van Nuys, you know, I hear from a lot of neighbors about the airport and what we can
do. I'm sure
you
do.
Yes,
and you will. If either of you are elected, you will hear a lot about.
And I grew up walking distance to that airport, so I'm very familiar with it and the issues there. And you know, I've pledged to work with the community.
All right. Briefly, the same question for you about how much influence would neighborhood councils have with you, Imelda Padilla?
Great question. So you know, I didn't just get involved with the neighborhood councils within the last 9 months of starting my campaign. I've been working with them for over a decade when I first got involved in 2009 with my own of Sun Valley for 4 years. And then I've continued to work with them, you know, in partnership to host things for youth, to host, you know, resource fairs and multiple things, because within their jurisdiction, you know, I want to be a partner with them, because with the budget, the very small budget that the city allocates for them, I do think we could do a lot together in partnership as it pertains to neighborhood purpose grants, which they give out. And then there's also the community impact statement that I think a lot of the neighborhood councils within District 6 are not empowered to use as often as they should. Some are better than others. Sun Valley is a pro at utilizing their community impact statements for things related to land use. Our LIDA has gotten better over the years, you know, but North Hills is a neighborhood council where everybody speaks complete Spanish. You can't go there and hear a meeting in English. It's fascinating. And they don't know how to use the community impact statement.
So this is something, if you were elected, your office could help with that.
Yeah, they, as mentioned by my opponent, they actually are a wealth of knowledge, you know, and they have their a very unique personality within the difference of every community. And not only do I intend to send my deputies to make sure that there's somebody there at every month, but as it pertains to important things coming up in their committees, I think we should also be sending... showing up to those. And I want to make sure that they're all empowered to utilize the community impact statement, because that's a formality of how to get their information and opinions into City Hall for us.
That's Imelda Padilla. We're talking with Ms. Padilla and Marissa Alcaraz, both of them candidates for District 6 LA City Council. I want to talk policing to close. And the majority of the council has made the point that, you know, they want to see a new model of policing moving toward mental health professionals taking many of the calls that are currently taken. But what we're seeing is a tremendous challenge with being able to hire enough mental health workers, frankly, to do the work. It's something sounds great in concept. Truly executing this is going to be a huge undertaking. I know people talk about Eugene, Oregon, the CAHOOTS program there, things like that. Much different scale. And the severity of drug addiction we're dealing with in Los Angeles is much greater than it was even a few years ago. So, Marissa Alcaraz, this is something you said you support new models of policing. How would you realistically do that? Where would you find and hire the people to execute this program?
You know, I've said that I support getting our police force back up to the 9,500 officers, as well as, you know, as you mentioned, investing in these alternative models. You know, the city has Circle, where they send out the officers with the mental health workers, the therapeutic van pools with more mental health care workers, and street medicine teams in partnership with USC, where they have, doctors and nurses actually out on the streets with medical assistance for our homeless individuals. So these are the types of programs that we're seeing positive results with, and we need to expand on and make sure it's expanding to the whole city and not just as pilots anymore. But part of it is also just a whole reimagining of our public safety system. And I think it kind of starts with the dispatch and how the calls go out and how we can be more efficient and not just sending officers, but sending the mental health care providers or maybe if community intervention workers in cases of gang issues. Denver has a great dispatch system that I think the city needs to look at as a potential model. But, you know, it all goes back to this conversation around reimagining policing. But, you know, as you mentioned, are the workers there? I think part of it is that we just need to pay workers more generally in our city. So many people I talk to talk about affordability problems in our city. And that's why, you know, I'm supporting bringing up wages again. And that's why I've been getting hit by some of these big business groups and PACs who have all gone against me, because I support raising wages and I've been pushing for it for, a long time.
That's Marissa Alcaraz. Imelda Padilla, same question for you. If policing is going to be reimagined, how do you, as a practical matter, actually do this?
So, I've been in the conversation related to how we re-envision and reimagine public safety for a very long time. I've specifically been working from the perspective of supporting youth and preventing crime in the first place. And I want to continue to do that work and work in partnership with, our public safety officers to make that happen. You know, I'm running to represent a community where young people's parents are working all the time. It's part of my own personal story, right? My father worked from 5 to 5. My mother worked from 3 to midnight. There was a good amount of time where me and my siblings were raising each other. And, you know, the effects of the criminal justice system and the school to prison pipeline did touch my family. So this is very personal to me and important to me. You know, but the political theory that I identify with is that I'm a constructivist and I believe that change happens incrementally. So we are, in my opinion, just at the very beginning of what the future of policing is going to look like for the next generation. And I'm excited to have that difficult conversation because social justice issues are never easy to fix overnight. But, you know, we wanted to specifically talk about the mental
real
health
briefly,
workers.
Yeah.
What we have to work with our institute, with our higher education institutions. I'm currently on the board of Valley College Foundation board. We were recently, before I decided to run for office, actually trying to figure out how we were going to develop an endowment so that we can, you know, support the creation of more nurses and more mental health.
So widen the pipeline of people
you
coming
have
into
to
the
widen
profession.
The pipeline.
I'm so sorry. I have to end us there. Thank you both very much for joining us and talking about the issues that are central in the city of Los Angeles and District 6 of the San Fernando Valley. That was just Imelda Padilla, from whom you heard, Marissa Alcaraz, both of them candidates for District 6 LA City Council. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3.
I did my best, but I guess my best wasn't good enough. 'Cause here we are back where we were before. Seems nothing ever changes. We're back to being strangers, wondering if we ought to stay or head on out the door.
Another great song from Cynthia Weil, Berry Man, as we pay tribute to Cynthia Weil, who died Friday. Music throughout the course of the 2 hours, some of their hits. That, of course, from Quincy Jones' The Dude album. James Ingram singing the song. Great to have you with us. And our backbone segments of Air Talk pay tribute to those who do a remarkable job of keeping this service coming your way. Our chief engineer, Lance Harper, joins us. Lance, good morning. Thanks so much. Share with us what it takes to keep all of our terrestrial transmitters on the air, because you travel throughout Southern California, Santa Barbara County, to way out to the southeasternmost end of the Coachella Valley.
That's right. We have transmitters from Santa Barbara all the way to Coachella. There's 11 broadcast sites altogether. There's five just for KPCC. We have Mount Wilson, our backup site at Flint Peak, our booster site in Santa Clarita up on Magic Mountain Peak off the 14 and Sand Canyon. And then we also have one on the west side, our newest one, our booster out in West Los Angeles.
So there's a lot. So you're constantly, and how do you get word if there's a problem with any of those facilities? Is it just a listener report, or is it, are you monitoring those actively?
I monitor them 24 hours a day. I have automation built into every one of those transmitters. And we also have a remote control backup on top of that. So if there's an error in one of the transmitters, let's say at KPCC up at Wilson, it'll notify me if it's still up. The backup system will notify me if it dies completely. Also, I have automation built in, too. So if the primary transmitter goes down, a secondary transmitter will kick in. And if both those die, the backup site will kick in. And they're all timed synchronously.
Wow.
So you shouldn't hear it as a listener when we transition between the backup site and the main site.
That's amazing. Now, how does the signal go from our facility on South Raymond Avenue in Pasadena to all these broadcasting sites?
Well, that's all over the place, actually. For KPCC, we have a fiber optic link between a point-to-point link between Raymond and Mount Wilson. Same for our backup site. But we also have an 18 gigahertz microwave link between here and the main site, and a 5.8 gigahertz link between here
as a backup
at the backup site.
In case the fiber line is not functional.
Correct, correct. Redundancy is the name of the game when broadcasting, especially in Los Angeles or New York or any major market. if you don't have backups, you're not ready for the game.
Well, and weather is a huge factor. I know you've had to take our four-wheel drive vehicle up to some pretty remote transmitter locations with roads that have washed out, with snow-covered roads. And I'm sure there is a bit of fun in that challenge, but it's got to be anxiety-producing at times.
The worst site we have is actually our Coachella site, KVLA. That site, it's a straight forest road that goes up. It's not a switchback road. So it's a 35-degree angle, straight-up dirt road that washes out every time they have the desert rains. So it's heavily rutted. But luckily, this last year, we were able to acquire a truck, a four-wheel drive truck. Used to be before, I would have to try to find one, a four-wheel drive vehicle, rent it, and then go up the mountain. But luckily, we got a grant last year, and we were able to get the four-wheel drive truck.
Listeners supporting us, we appreciate that very much. Lance, thank you for coming in, talking about the technical job of getting the signal to our listeners. We appreciate it very much.
I appreciate you, too.
Thank you, Lance Harper, joining us, our chief engineer here at LAist 89.3.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.